Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Elizabeth Kennedy, who's a social scientist doing research with children and families in Honduras and El Salvador that has been widely used in asylum claims. And currently, she's a consultant with the Norwegian Refugee Council's Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. Welcome to Background Briefing, Elizabeth Kennedy.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Elizabeth, I'm operating on the assumption, in fact, it was expressed by the former head of Homeland Security, Jay Johnson, who said recently in a television interview that for all of Donald Trump's toughness and making this so-called tough stand on the border, ripping children from their parents, etc., and he keeps referring to being tough, 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 and the Democrats are weak. But for all of that macho rhetoric, at the end of the day, nothing that Trump does will solve this problem unless you direct its root causes and start to deal with conditions in El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, and Mexico. I take it that you believe that to be the case.
Yes, it's definitely important to address the conditions in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras so that those who are born here and have their families and homes here can stay. For me, I've been working on this topic, doing research with children and families for almost a decade now. And I know children and families who live in the United States, in addition to other countries outside of where they were born and built their homes. If they could return home and be safe, they would do so. Unfortunately, they cannot. And this causes them a great deal of pain. So the focus should be on helping to create the conditions so that people don't have to flee their homes. No one ever wants to be in a position where they have to do that.
Well, it seems though that Donald Trump is more intent on scoring political points with his absurd exaggerations that the MS-13 street gangs are taking over America, when in fact, as far as I can tell, they've all but taken over El Salvador.
Right. Well, Trump has had an interesting focus on the gang MS-13. The gang MS-13 was created in the United States and was exported or deported to El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala in the late 1990s as a result of changes in our immigration law, reforms in 1996 specifically. Those countries, particularly Guatemala and El Salvador, had just ended decades-long civil war, were more or less destroyed, had a number of children, families, and communities suffering from trauma that had taken place over years, lost families, lost wages, no infrastructure. So it was a perfect storm. Gangs were able to take root, and we're talking about membership in the tens of thousands in the region, whereas in the United States, it's estimated that there's a population of 10,000. Whether it's the United States, El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras, though, if you truly want to get rid of gangs, then you need to focus on the problems of poverty. You know, the young people that end up in gangs are from the poorest communities where they don't have access to educational and economic opportunities. They often suffer abuse in the home and in the streets. They are lacking protection from the state, from their family, from their schools. They face stigma and are treated poorly because of where they're from, how they dress, what they don't have. If we really want gangs not to be able to recruit or to thrive, then we should instead offer loving and caring communities to these young people so that they're able to turn to those persons and those organizations instead for protection and belonging.
And apart from, say, the Catholic Church, are there any state organizations that offer those services?
Unfortunately, state organizations tend to be focused on security-based solutions, so trying to crack down or imprison youth from these neighborhoods. Typically, they are brown-skinned and black-skinned, and the United States, just as is the case in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, has rather discriminatory practices towards these youth and their communities. They've focused a lot more on practices that further entrench gangs instead of allowing these communities to build themselves up, to establish trust with each other. And I mean, one of the most important things here is also addressing, you know, generational trauma, different crises and abuses that have been suffered over time and throughout generations, learning how to react to those situations differently is very difficult, especially without the tools necessary to do that. And so instead, programs should be focused on that. There are a number of communities that have such nonprofit organizations doing just this, but the state itself, unless we're talking about a handful of states in the United States, don't tend to take those approaches.
Well, Donald Trump, of course, is militarizing the border and wants to build a wall. And now huge amounts of money are going to ICE and Border Patrol, and also huge amounts of money are going into building these prisons that they're going to house these families in, assuming that they can find children and the parents and reunite them. So a lot of money is being spent at this end. Could that money be spent in countries like where you are in Honduras and El Salvador and Guatemala and Mexico in terms of foreign aid? In other words, would it be cheaper for the U.S. to address the problems that you're talking about rather than try and cope with the consequences here on our southern border?
This is a big question because obviously money can always be put to a different and better use that could likely have the type of impact that most of us in society desire. However, there's always vested interest involved with money and who gets it. In the region of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, it's very difficult for community-based organizations to get their hands on the foreign aid that arrives. Because of changes that were made during the Bush administration, I believe organizations abroad now have to have an operating budget of almost $1 million or more annually. So what that means is that you get international organizations who get the original contract and then subcontract out, sometimes two levels down. So whereas that international organization will get $2 or $3 million from U.S. foreign aid, the actual community-based organization that does the day-to-day work and knows the context on the ground will end up with $10,000 or so. So I think one big question we need to be having is how foreign aid is allocated, particularly to grassroots organizations and community organizations. The other problem is that even in the region, the majority of the funding that arrives is security-based. So that type of community programming or nonviolence programming often gets tied up and doesn't arrive in the same amounts that were promised, whereas money for weapons, for military equipment, does always manage to make its way into the hands of what we know are corrupt military and police.
Well, we're certainly turning a blind eye to the leader of Honduras and the people in his government who have ties to drug traffickers, same in Guatemala, which is a sort of narco-democracy, and in Nicaragua, which has been fairly stable and hasn't had a huge outflow. Now you have a dictatorial government shooting its own people in the streets in order to cling onto power. So you could have another wave coming from Nicaragua to add to the waves from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. So surely, I mean, is there anything that the U.S. can do? There's going to be a change of government in Mexico with López Obrador being, I think, less sympathetic to Trump than probably any Mexican president in history. What do you think about the idea of better governance and better leadership in these countries?
Well, one thing I've always thought in the region is that, for example, Mexico has a lot, in some ways, has a lot more in common with El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras than with the United States. And to the extent that El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras are going to be able to apply adequate pressure to tell the United States no to certain items or to better advocate for their citizens outside of their countries of origin, they probably do need an ally like Mexico. And Mexico could benefit from that alliance as well. You know, part of the problem is that historically, the money and choices that the United States has made in the region have further strengthened corrupt entities, have fortified or overlooked abuses of human rights, and have focused more than anything on economic interest and maintaining a very limited, powerful economic elite. the United States needs to reevaluate that, because as long as you allow large portions of society to live in extreme poverty, a type of poverty that most in the United States don't know and cannot comprehend, those conditions are never good conditions. Desperate people will do desperate things, and it would be much better to provide and to encourage countries to provide for their citizens a basic standard of living, and also provide all young people with the opportunities to maximize their potential, because that ultimately benefits everyone in society, not just the child and his or her family.
So obviously that's a heavy lift in terms of finding ways to improve the economies of these countries. But given the tradition and the history of inequality, which, by the way, we have here in this country, and it's growing, I'm not sure, you know, how we are necessarily setting the example. But is there any indication of a way that you would see, since you work in these countries, that you could start addressing poverty without addressing economic inequality and bad governance?
Yes, and I think you hit the nail on the head. The United States struggles with these problems as well. And in this sense, we are exporting our weaknesses and requiring that other countries adapt them as their own. The United States also, there are some exceptions when you start looking into differences between the 50 states, but the United States also has a heavy concentration of resources in its elite and has a deteriorating education system, a deteriorating health system, and doesn't particularly put a lot of focus, care, concern on providing a strong social safety net. In this regard, the United States likely won't be the example. You might want to see the Nordic countries, for example, providing their know-how and expertise on what that could look like in the region. And this may be one of the side effects of the U.S. losing power and standing internationally, that other countries could have more of an influence in what has typically been a stronghold for the United States foreign policy and interest.
Well, but most of America's foreign aid, the biggest recipient of America's foreign aid is Israel. And I think Egypt is second. So that they take up the lion's share. So I don't know where you find a constituency for Central America and Mexico, except they happen to be our neighbors. You would think that that would be where our focus is on our own neighborhood. But curiously enough, our foreign policy focus appears to be elsewhere.
Definitely. And obviously my expertise is in El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala, but the United States certainly sends a large amount of primarily military aid to other parts of the world and has equally problematic relationships in doing so and documented human rights abuses. I'm not advocating that the United States not invest in the region. I have long thought that the United States should evaluate how it invests in the region, because there's historical precedent and ongoing precedent that they don't necessarily do so in the way that's truly going to create change, and change is very much needed.
Well, Elizabeth Kennedy, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Likewise, thank you again for having me.
And I've been speaking with Elizabeth Kennedy, who is a social scientist doing research with children and families in Honduras and El Salvador that has been widely used in asylum claims. And currently she's a consultant with the Norwegian Refugee Council's Internal Displacement Monitoring Center. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Larivalat. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. We can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.